Good morning, everybody, and welcome to another edition of Morning Drive here on 89.7 WTBR here in Pittsfield, also 88.1 WSBR in Lee. Bob Heck here with you on a Wednesday morning, and this is another pre-recorded show, so I'm still not talking about the Super Bowl because as we record this, the Super Bowl has not happened yet, so I might be happy, I might be sad. If the Patriots win or lose, you'll know by my demeanor. If you're friends with me on Facebook, you'll know my demeanor pretty quickly as well. And today we have on the show a good friend of the show for quite a while. Not this show, but my shows in particular. We got Kevin Bartini. Kevin, what's going on, man?
Hey, man, how you doing? Good to see you again.
Good to see you, too. What's up with the hair, man?
It's a little longer, isn't it?
Yeah, you look like Pandemic Kevin again.
A bit. That's, yeah, it's a little change. Really, the thing about it is because I've been focusing more on getting acting work and character work and stuff like that. So it's easier for a role to, you know, cut the hair the way they want it than to have to grow it out or do some
gotcha.
Stupid work. So it's not that spiky hair that I used to have. It's just kind of a bit longer in the back and stuff like that. And takes some getting used to, but that's it. Plus, I just don't want to look like I don't want anybody to look at me because the other thing is, like, I'm in my mid-40s. I'm a little doughy, a little out of shape. I'm a white guy. And I'm like, I'm doing everything I can physically just to make people not think that there's a chance I might be in ice. You know?
Yeah.
The less I can look like those guys, the better. That's what I'm
completely understood. I mean, yeah. The hair doesn't really grow for me anymore, so I don't really have that option. So the last time we spoke on the radio was, it had to have been about 10 years ago when I did my farewell show on WBRK, and we did the show, and you didn't know we were doing the show.
Ah, I think I remember that.
Yeah, you know, it was like, oh, Kevin's a little subdued today. He's not bringing it, but that's okay. Maybe it's a somber thing because it was my last show. And then you went on Facebook an hour later. It's like, I didn't even realize I was on the air. So for folks not familiar with you, and of course, I would say a lot of people are familiar with you. Where'd you get your start? We had Berkshire Theater Group on yesterday talking about their youth programs. And, you know, you sort of got a start. Your starts as an actor within similar programs. Tell us about that.
Very much so. My start goes with youth training at Shakespeare and Company.
Okay.
R.I.P. Tina Packer, a wonderful, wonderful woman who had a wonderful just what she did to the Berkshires and is amazing. She was a very nice lady, and I liked her a lot. Going to miss her. But the thing with Shakespeare and Company, as people in the Berkshires know, if you have kids in the school system, high school age, they have the Fall Festival of Shakespeare, which is where they take their own, their own professional actors, directors, company members, and they send them out to, I don't know, right now, maybe a dozen, 15 schools, it fluctuates, all over the region. And they teach, you know, professional Shakespearean acting and give you a great insight into, you know, theater, acting, things like that, much more so than just your standard, everyday middle America high school where the drama club consists of, the gym teacher and, and they're doing Our Town or something like that. So this really was a lot different, a lot better. And the thing is, like, it's not, they never designed this program as a way to churn out people into show business, which is why, there's not a lot of big celebrities that came from this or anything else as far as the entertainment industry. I'm probably one of the three most successful in the entertainment part, but what they teach and what you learn from it are skills and things that people are able to use in their daily lives, in work, so many things. It's not really funny to talk about, but it's a wonderful program. And so that's what got my start, was wanting to be a comedian, knowing I wanted to be a comedian since I was a little boy. And I decided that I was going to have to be comfortable on stage. So the Berkshires and the theater scene was it for me. And, you know, it was mainly Shakespeare and Company, and they're the ones that I have a main still relationship with. But I also did a summer as an apprentice at Williamstown, and I've done some stuff with Barrington Stage. And I don't know that I've done anything with Berkshire Theater Group yet, but you know, it's a really wonderful area, the Berkshires, for obviously for theater, for arts, and for stuff like that. And so I was very fortunate that where I grew up, and that I grew up with Shakespeare and Company, gave me a huge edge up in my career. Because when I started, I had confidence on stage. And that's the most important thing, especially at the beginning, to look like you know what you're doing. The audience doesn't want to see somebody go on stage who, you know, who they can tell their body language and everything just mm-hmm. isn't comfortable up there. You know, I teach comics and stuff like that sometimes. And one thing I talk to them about with this, and the analogy I say, is that every time I get on an airplane, right, first thing I do is I step foot on the plane. I take a look to my left. I look in the cockpit, and I look for the pilot. And I don't care if the pilot's a man or a woman. I don't care if he's black or if he's white. I don't care if he's gay or if he's straight. And I don't care what God he prays to, if he prays to a God. The only thing I want to see is I want to see the pilot looks like you, Bob. I want to see some sandy gray hair right on the side. I need little age in the temples. That's all. Because that tells me that guy's been, it's not his first day, right? Mm-hmm. I can go sit and put in it. So it's the same thing. Be comfortable on stage. And look like you walk in there knowing what you're doing. So it's with anything else. It's confidence. And boy, that was really wonderful what I got from Shakespeare and Company and from all of that. Because at the very beginning, it put me a league ahead of everybody else starting at the same time. And I stood out. And that got me into clubs easier. And that got me more road work easier and other things. And then, you know, I think that's wonderful. And I'm so grateful. And so to this day, I still come home and do stuff at Shakespeare and help them fundraise and do anything they ask, I'm there.
Now, you said you wanted to get into comedy at an early age. And I was going to ask how you transitioned from Shakespeare and Company to getting into comedy, but it sounded like you wanted to get into comedy. And that's what led you to Shakespeare and Company.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I was about 5-6 years old when I realized that's what I wanted to do. In the 80s, there was a lot of stand-up comedy on television. A lot of old, you know, at that point, 10-year-old sketches from Saturday Night Live being rebroadcast in half-hour formats. You know, I was immersed in it, and I just was also the funny kid. And I was like, wow, this is something for me. So knowing what I wanted to do very young was great, you know, and all. But the thing is, you have to plan and plan ahead. And so even as a young guy, I was like, okay, I understand. I'm going to have to, you know, back then it was really not even that I was conscious that I had to be comfortable on stage as a comic. The reason I was into the acting part is because back in the 80s, every stand-up was being given their own sitcom and their own stuff. So I was like, well, I'm going to have to, at some point when they have my sitcom, I'm going to have to be good on it. So I better learn how to act and do all that stuff. So it was very fortunate where I grew up and how I grew up and all that. And that my parents were so supportive of it. And, you know, that was a wonderful thing too.
Who were your influences growing up in comedy? And I have a feeling you're going to say one, because we see one right over your shoulder there.
Oh, yeah. Well, I had a lot of influences, but yeah, obviously George Carlin, Jerry Seinfeld. I saw Jerry Seinfeld was the first comedian I ever saw perform live. If you don't count his opening act, and I was 12 years old, and that was in Lenox, Massachusetts, right at the same facility where Shakespeare and Company is now. Back then it was, I forget what it was called. But anyway, that big if you go down Shakespeare and Company, the field house, it's a big, almost like a hockey arena in there, you know? And that was at the time, now they use it for storage and for production stuff, but at the time was a big full-fledged, probably sat a, you know, 800, 1,000, I don't even know. And Jerry Seinfeld came and it was his second year of his show. And I got to see him live in Lenox. And, you know, I've performed in that building numerous times now. So that's kind of cool. But it was really, it's the guys, Dennis Miller. I don't love his politics and the way things have turned out with, you know, that. Mm-hmm. But he was a huge influence on that. Smart as a whip, expecting the audience to get the reference, expecting the audience to be smart, literate, hip. Have some idea of maybe some cultural references out of literature and cinema and things like that. I loved that. So those are the kind of guys that I dug. And Mel Brooks and Woody Allen and, you know, hundreds and hundreds of influences. I was just soaking it all up. The original SNL people, all that kind of stuff. There was so many when you're starting out. And that's as the way it should be. If you want to get into something like this, you should immerse yourself in it and, you know, soak up just as much as you can, because you never know. To this day, I never know what each day is going to bring, what job I might pick up, what gig, what I might have to do. And so it's cool to have, to have those skill sets and to be able to do some stuff and be ready to roll when jobs come along.
Now, you recently started writing for something called Odd News. Tell me about that.
Oh, what a fun gig this is. I love it. Oddnews.com is a it's obviously a webpage. First of all, they sought me out, which was great. You know, they reached out to me and asked if I'd be interested to work for them. And basically, the idea is I have free reign. I can write whatever I want, whenever I want. I don't have a deadline, and I don't have a minimum number of anything I have to do in a week or whatever. The idea is all I have to do is take a story, something from the current news, and that can be very wide thing.
There's so a lot to choose from nowadays.
A lot to choose from, and I can just take anything from the news. And it can be a small local story out of, you know, Nome, Alaska. It doesn't matter. It could have been a story that affected two people. It doesn't matter. It's just a jumping off point for me to write. Basically, I try to write a news article type thing that's completely fictitious. It's completely made up. The only thing is the one kernel of truth that at some point something similar happened somewhere or something. And then it's... The goal for me is to sometimes make it as close to, you know, you want it to look like somebody can almost, you can trick them to think that this really happened. And sometimes, obviously, it's crazy. I've done stuff where I've interviewed talking animals, and I've done things where, you know, but that's a fun thing. I can write anything I want in any way I want. And I'm so enjoying it. And it's, you know, I've wanted for a long time, you know, to write more. You know, there's always that, oh, do you have a spec script, this and that. And I don't think that I have a great one. One of my shortcomings is I'm not great about homework, right? I can't just sit down. And if I was going to write a novel or something like that, you know, it's a job. You got to go sit down. You got to sit at your computer. You got to stare at that blank screen. You can't go shooting off onto the internet playing solitaire or anything else. You just got to stare at that screen and you got to do it. And you got to build that as a habit. So that's the nice thing about this, is it's starting to build a habit into me of, yeah, you write every day or you research, you do this kind of stuff. And then even if it's a day where I don't find a news story that excites me, and stimulates an idea, I'm still in the process and the mindset of writing, I may end up working on something else. And I think that's good, because I have a lot of premises and things and ideas I've never gotten to. So, you know, as far as, you know, the state of the world, the state of my career, the state of what I want to be doing, what works for me, at this point in time, you know, it's not the world's highest paying gig I've ever had, or you know, but it's really, I'm really enjoying it. And it's wonderful that I don't look, it's, you know, it's been sub-zero. I don't have to leave the house to write, you know. The idea of going out on the road like I used to doesn't appeal to me anymore. So it's like, you know, I'm transitioning now because I'm in my middle ages and I don't, you know, I want to kind of plan out the career path or something to get me through the second half, and doing it the way that, you know, works for me. And so this, it's really exciting. And they've got a lot of really good writers on there and good stuff. And so it's oddnews.com. If you're a person who enjoys The Onion, enjoys stuff like that, McSweeney's, you'd find it funny, I hope, and enjoy it.
Oddnews.com.
It's on the internet and it's free.
So you grew up in Lee, of course, and now you're down in New York City. Talk to me about that move and, you know, that moment where you decided you were all in on comedy.
Well, I mean, that we're going back, God, 27 years. Mm-hmm. So 25, 26 years. Well, I mean, without getting too maudlin, this past Monday marked 26 years since my brother was killed. He was 18 and I was 20 when it happened. I'd been out of high school a couple of years, studying, if you want to say that, up at BCC, just kind of spinning my wheels. I was never a good student, but I was still too young to do anything. And I was having a crisis of conscience at that point, a little of my own. Do I really want to do that? Or maybe maybe I just want to have a regular job and go be a cook or sell cars. I don't know. But when my brother died, that kind of just solidified it right there. You know, that life is very short, that you might as well go try something. And I was 20. I had no children, no wife, no mortgage. Thanks to BCC, no college loans.
Yeah.
You know, I moved down to the city with a couple thousand dollars in my bank account, and that's it. And that didn't last long. And that was the whole thing. It was just, you know, it was 1 year. For the first year after my brother died, I started doing stand-up in the area, which meant going out to Albany. And that was it. There was no stand-up in the Berkshires back then. There was nothing, you know. So it would go to Albany, do some spots, and just started to get my footing, started to understand how to do that. And about a year later, I moved down with two other guys who I had met at Barrington Stage Company. And yeah, just started open mics and things like that and plugging away. And then it was not long, only a month or two before, again, because I was advanced when I started with the being good on stage, like I was hired to work the door at a club here in New York City, and it just kind of was my entree into things. So it's when you're 20 and you don't have any, you know, any responsibilities or anything, it's like, hey, why don't go have an adventure? And I kind of thought it, I never gave myself like really if you haven't done this by the time you're 25, well then you're gonna give it up and go home, you know. It's like, just 25 came and things were going okay, and then 30 came and things were going better, and that's just how it worked.
Interesting. And you know, as you're putting an act together, you know, I suppose the scariest part is you don't know what's really funny until you do it in front of a crowd, right? Does that make sense?
Yeah.
I mean, I have an idea of what's funny, but
sure.
Something you've probably written jokes for the stage where you laughed like crazy as you wrote it, and then it just bombed when you delivered it.
Yeah, that happens. Mm-hmm. It's just a part of the process. I mean, you don't go. Nobody in the NBA hits every foul shot they ever take.
Right.
You know, you throw the ball up and you're aiming at the hoop, and you may get nothing but net, and it may brick. And it's just a numbers game, really. You know, you go up and you do and you do and you get stronger and you start to find, you know, the bits that work versus the bits that don't. And those bits that work stick around, the bits that don't disappear. And then an act starts to gel. You can all of a sudden, I can go up and do 5 minutes. Now I can do 10. And now, wow, now 15 and 20 and it builds. And the next thing, you know, oh, it's an hour. And now it's like, you know, I have a few hours combined of material that I've recorded and released. And I've got plenty of other things I can do on stage, you know. But bombing is something that is a fear more for a layman than a comedian. Once you're doing it, it's just a part of it. And you build up some sort of a hardened candy shell around you, you know, and you just kind of live somewhere in the gray area between your greatest set ever and your worst set ever. And the rest is in the gray area. You know, so I bombed plenty. I bombed a couple of weeks ago. I mean, as a headliner, I bombed. It happens. It's not the worst thing in the world. I mean, it's not great, but you just move on. You go and you do the next show the next day and hope the next one goes better.
I think that's the most...
It doesn't. And if it doesn't, and then if you keep bombing and you keep bombing, well, then maybe, you know, maybe the world is telling you it's time to go pick up a paintbrush or something.
Well, it's interesting because a lot of comedians don't give such a level-headed answer to that. You hear comedians in interviews, and they're terrified of bombing. And, you know, they could tell you the exact moment that they bombed the worst and where they were. And you're so level-headed about it.
Yeah, man. I mean, it's just, it's... Look, there's ego, mm-hmm. you know, guy, and you don't want to be the headliner. You don't want to, you know, you don't want to be the main attraction and end up sucking for a full hour. You know, you don't want that. But really, when you think about it, all it is people are afraid of embarrassment, afraid of being, you know, looking like an ass for however long. But, you know, once you realize those people are all strangers,
yep.
Most of them, you know, and even to the point where I am not in my career, and when I go out and I headline comedy clubs and stuff like that, I know I'm not famous, you know, I'm not well known enough that I'm a draw on the road, you know, so I know that the people still coming to the comedy club that night are coming because it's a comedy club, not because of who the headliner is. So I still feel a little bit of anonymity in that way, that even if I bomb, people are going to forget who I am. They don't give a shit. They'll go see another guy. So once you get that mental attitude, like, it's just everything's temporary. Embarrassment's temporary. 2 weeks, 2 days later, even if I went out tonight and had a terrible set and embarrassed myself, when the people go the next day to work or whatever and tell their friends about this, maybe they'll remember my name. Friends not going to know who the hell I am. A couple of days later, these people are going to forget about it. And that is 10 times more true for the opening acts and the developing comics. They're, you know, bombing is... Look, if you can't stand the sight of blood, don't become a doctor. You know, bombing is a part of it. You can't crush until you bomb. You have to have both. You have mm-hmm. to. And so it's not that big a deal. It's just, you know, whether you kill or whether you bomb, at the end of the day, you're going to go home. You're going to go to bed. You're going to get up the next day and life goes on.
It's funny you mentioned that because I'm sure you remember this a few years back. I went on a cruise and mm-hmm. I saw a comedy show and it was awful. I hated it.
Yeah.
And I gave you the names and I know this one and I don't know who the other one is. Mm-hmm. I don't remember their names anymore.
Exactly. Exactly. You almost never do. I mean, go ahead and think back to all the rock concerts you've ever seen. Can you name all the opening acts you ever saw? You know, it's that thing. And especially when you're on a cruise ship. I mean, I did cruise ships for 9 months, though. That was rough. you know, and it's like, those poor comics and those people on that ship are very, very much hamstrung by the limitations put on them by the ship, as far as things you can't talk about. Obviously, you can't be dirty. You can't do this. You can't do that. You have, you know. So it doesn't make for great necessarily shows all the time. But yeah, you don't remember the guys who bomb or whatever. So it's you know. I also, going back to like when I coach young comics, I put it this way. I was like, picture yourself walking buck naked down Main Street of your hometown. Okay. Now, what would be worse? Buck naked walking the Main Street of your hometown, or being buck naked walking the Main Street of a town you've never visited before and will never return to? You know what I mean? At the end of the day, the people in both towns are going to be like, hey, did you hear about the naked guy and all that? But only in the town of Lee are the people going to be like, that was Kevin, and I know his parents, and then when they, you know, and I know this, and then they start talking, and then it's all that something. But in the other town, it's just, hey, some random naked guy was on the street, and then we move on with our lives.
That's fantastic advice. We're here with Kevin Bartini, comedian down in New York City, grew up in Lee, does a lot of stuff with Shakespeare and company. We're going to be right back with more from Kevin Bartini coming up in just a little bit here on Morning Drive, here on 89.7 WTBR.
Morning Drive here on WTBR FM.
Pittsfield Community Radio, 89.7 WTBR FM Pittsfield, 88.1 WSBR Lee.
Support for WTBR comes from Berkshire Community College. Free community college for any Massachusetts resident without a bachelor's degree at BCC. Find out more at berkshirecc.edu. And from Sundrini Awnings and Home Improvement, providing awnings and canopies in Western Mass. Retractable awnings, retractable screens, gutter and gutter protection systems, commercial awnings and screen rooms, customized solutions available. Online at sundrini.com.
PCTV Select is now available on so many platforms. You can get it with any device you have available, all free to download and use. If you're watching at home, use your Roku, Amazon, Fire TV, or Apple TV device, or even your computer, and see programming in full HD quality. Watching on the go? Download PCTV Select from the Apple App Store or the Google Play Store for your smartphone. It's that easy and free. PCTV Select is everywhere you need to be.
Hey, I'm Kyle.
And I'm Riley.
Do you like 90s alternative?
Do you like 2000s emo?
Are you tired of the same old predictable radio?
Tune in to Zennial Yearbook on WTVR. We're playing the best alternative songs from the 90s and early 2000s.
We're playing Green Day, Foo Fighters,
Blink-182, Weezer, and more My Chemical Romance than is required by law.
So tune your Walkman to 89.7 FM WTBR. Saturdays at 2 p.m. for all this and more.
It's Zennial Yearbook!
Support for WTBR comes from Greylock Federal Credit Union, proud to support high school arts and sports programs to help our community thrive. Greylock Federal, with locations throughout the Berkshires and online at greylock.org.
And from UCP of Western Massachusetts. UCP of Western Mass is hiring full and part-time opportunities to provide a life without limits for people with disabilities. For more information, ucpwma.org/jobs.
You have chosen wisely.
WTBR. And now back to the Morning Drive on WTBR-FM, Pittsfield Community Radio.
Happy Wednesday morning to you. Thanks for tuning in to 89.7 WTBR. Bob Heck here with you. This is a pre-recorded show, so... Yeah, I don't know what happened in the Super Bowl yet. I'm actually in real life at this moment down in Florida. I think I'm hitting my my first tee shot right about now. So, yeah, so that's why we're doing some pre-recorded things. And we're thrilled and honored to have Kevin Bartini on with us from Lee. Grew up in Lee, now lives in New York City as a comedian. And has been doing it for quite a while. And we were talking before the break about bombing and I suppose another necessary evil that comedians have to deal with. And you said on you have something on your website about a class coming up where you teach people how to deal with hecklers. And it's really interesting nowadays that we get into the social media and all the comedians have their Twitters and things like that. And some of the comedians put out, how are they dealing with the hecklers? And it's always interesting to see some of the different variety of ways people are doing it and what the responses are. How do you deal with it?
Well, the first thing that you have to do when you deal with a heckler is you have to come up in your own mind and understand what is that person's motivation for heckling, right? Mm-hmm. Because that's a pretty general term. It really just means somebody who's in the audience is speaking and stealing focus from the stage. Now, that can be because they're enjoying the show. You know, maybe they can be a person that, you know, like my grandmother, who would laugh at something and then kind of repeat the punchline almost without, you know, realizing. Or, you know, or maybe I just said something on stage that, you know, that reminds you of, or it's just like what happened. And so then you turn to your wife or something and you're sharing. There's all that kind of stuff. Or maybe they're just having a good time and they think that they're helping and all that kind of stuff. So I try to assess their motivation in deciding how I'm going to respond to it, right? And if they come at me and if they're negative, which is rare, I got to tell you, it doesn't happen a lot.
Okay.
People, the layman, when they think about doing stand-up, they think, well, what's the work, you know, every night you're going to bomb and also you're going to be, you know, pilloried. You're going to have people hollering at you and calling you. That doesn't really happen. What happens is 9 times out of 10, it's just somebody who's drunk. You know, I was at Governor's this past weekend on Long Island, and I was in the last 5 minutes of my time, you know, and right up front, there was two people. And the woman was drunk, and I was doing one bit, and she just started at first, like, that's not true or something like that. And it was enough, you know, it was enough that it distracted in a bit. So I turned, and first I engaged, like, what's not true and what, and then as soon as I ascertained that she's drunk, well, then you start teasing about that and throwing some jokes out there. Thing is, really, the rest of the audience is on your side when it comes to a heckler.
Yeah.
Or when it comes to somebody who's being loud or anything else, they're on your side. They're annoyed at, look at this drunk. You know, they want you to take her apart a little bit and stuff. But still at the same time, that lady left there, and I guarantee the next morning she didn't wake up feeling like she was an ass, feeling like she was assaulted by the comedian or anything else. She had a great time, and I just worked it in. I don't, you know, you got to get to a point where again, like with the pilot analogy, where you're just so comfortable in the cockpit that it doesn't matter. It's just a storm cloud, you know, it's just lightning. I've seen it before, and it's not the end of the world, and it's not, you know, it's not personal generally. But if you do have somebody who's negative, and, you know, there's somebody belligerent, something like that, somebody wants to straight up call, you know, do whatever. Well, then it's kind of, I mean, like they do in prison movies, you know, your first day there, you find the biggest guy and you beat the hell out of him. And that way people know not to mess with you. It's kind of the same thing. Like when I do crowd work, when I would talk to people and do things like that, you know, I have limits to what I would make fun of. There's basically, I don't like to make fun of somebody for something that, quote unquote, is God's fault, right?
Yep.
You can't help if you got an ugly face. You can't help if you got snaggle tooth. You can't help if you're going bald. You can't help if you're wildly obese. You can't help about anything like that. So I would never make fun of somebody for those things. But if you come in at a comedian negatively and you're the first one, that's the first thing I'm going for. You fat this and that. And I will, you know, I will pummel. And I've done that. And I'll tell you, there was one story was one night. It was Broadway Comedy Club. And I was the closer on the show. And so when I got to the club, you know, the show had been going on for an hour. And the host says to me, I just want to let you know, there's this table. It's a mother and two daughters. They're all drunk. They're right up front, and they are absolutely ruining the show for every person, for everybody, and nobody. And because nobody was stepping to them, nobody was standing up to them and calling them out, So when I got on stage, you also know that the rest of the audience hates them too, right? Because these people paid a lot of money.
Yeah.
For a comedy show, a professional show, the drinks are expensive, and now it's just getting ruined one after the next. So I started out when I got on stage. I didn't say a joke or anything. I'm just like, it was really nice. I'm working right around the room. I hope you guys, I'm looking forward to being here and performing. And I hope you guys, we're going to have a lot of fun in a moment. And then I got right over to this table and I just says, and you three, I hope you're in a taxi accident later tonight, and I just started like that. I hope. And they, of course, they started at me and they were just right away. It was like three drunken white trash mother and daughters out of like Oklahoma or something like that, and you could tell they have seven ex-husbands amongst them and just no class. And so everything they were saying, when she was like, I walked them, I did get them to leave, I just kept hitting them even though they'd been winning the whole night. I took probably the first 5 minutes, and to the point where they were like, I'm gonna go on Yelp and I'm gonna write about the club. And I was like, cool, I'll look for your notes, what's your handle, some drunken whore, things like that. And they were pissed and they left screaming and crying, but they left. And then the audience clapped and were relieved, and then I went back into it and I had a great set and the rest of the night was fine. But you have to be judicious. You can't go attacking the person right away until you know that they have it coming. And then once they have it coming, then it's off to the races, because then it's stuff that you can't normally say in real life. Mm-hmm. That can be fun.
That sounds like a blast when you get to just take the gloves off and go hammering at somebody who absolutely deserves it.
Oh, my God. Yeah. Oh, absolutely. It's like when I'm on Reddit and I see these videos of somebody just being a total ass to some minority, like at a gas station or something. Mm-hmm. Just feel emboldened right now. I wish I was there.
It sort of brings up a moment. One of the coolest moments, one of the coolest dad moments I've had is my kids came up to me showing me this video of a show called What Would You Do? And you were a carnival barker playing guess weight, height, and the first one was a little person, and then the second was somebody obese, and I got to say, yeah, that's my friend Kevin.
Yeah, I know that guy. Oh, they just legit brought you that clip?
Oh, yeah.
No kidding.
Yeah, they showed it. It's like, this is hilarious. You got to see this.
Oh, God, that's hilarious. Oh, that's awesome. I love that.
How did you get hooked up with that?
That was just a straight-up audition.
Really? Okay.
Yeah. I've done 3 or 4 of them now. And it was just go in and audition. And I remember on that one, so What Would You Do? I was the carnival barker, and there was a little fella, and he was in his 40s. He was very much like that actor, what's his name, from Game of Thrones.
Dinklage?
Yeah. In the way he carried himself, mm-hmm. He was in his 40s and all that. And then there was this kid, and he was probably 12, and, he was round as a beach ball. And with both of them, it was as they would walk by, I'd be the carnival barker. So what would happen if he starts attacking this kid and making jokes? And what happened is people were really standing up for the kid. And
you could definitely tell the difference between the two.
Yeah. And it was like, because the kid, he just seemed so much more defenseless. Like the dude was like, he was, you could tell, like, in real life, that guy would have probably punched me. You know what I mean? He wasn't going to take it. But so like when the audition came or whatever, I think, they put you in a room and they gave you the scenario. And I think I just had to start saying things, coming up with lines of what I would say if it was somebody who was, who was overweight or something. So it was just off the top of my head. And I remember during the audition banging out about 5 or 6 lines. I remember with the guy, the little guy, that was one of the things you couldn't, the only thing with him was I couldn't say midget. That was the only thing. You can't use that. which was fine. But I remember, like, right off the bat, I remember in the audition, and I'm pretty sure this one made the air, I asked him what is harder, you know, screwing in a light bulb or playing with a yo-yo. And that,
that's such a great line.
Right? And it just came off the top of my head. And I remember in the audition, after that, I think after that line, that the producer turned to the other ones and goes, his lines are better than the ones you wrote. And I was like, oh, man. And so I got that one. And what a great gig. It was a lot of fun. And as I said, I've had the opportunity to do three or four others. And it's, I love hearing the people are watching it and actually like that, like, naturally, organically showing it to you.
Oh,
like,
yeah, it was an absolute cool moment. And the other one that's when you were doing the slip and fall
at the
restaurant. How many times did you do the slip and fall? I mean, that looked like a painful day.
I did I must have done at least a dozen of them. No, it wasn't. Back to, and this will bring it right back around, to thank you, Shakespeare and Company, and my theatrical training. I know how to take stage fall. It looked a lot more painful than it really was, but in effect, all I was doing was sliding into second base. You know, I was just kind of going down, hitting my leg, hitting the meaty part of my butt, and using my arms or whatever to act and make it look bigger. So to answer your question, I think the only thing at the end of the day I left with was my belly was burning because I had been drinking coffee all day. It was like an early morning thing. Beyond that, physically, I was fine. I can do stage falls all day. They're fun. But I got to tell you, I do. I it warms my heart when I do hear people say like what you did, like that. Oh, my kids brought this to me, and I said, you know, or if my dad, has a friend who told us years ago that he brought his son to my webpage and said, look at this guy, you know, and there's the pictures with John Stewart and Steven and all these different things. And he's like, look at this, look at all he's accomplished and look at all this stuff. And he's from Lee. He grew up, you know, he was born and raised in the house next door to my parents. So it's like, if he can do this, you can. And when I heard that, I was like, wow, that blew my mind. You know, like, yeah, all right, I'll take that. It feels good. I love that.
That's awesome. Cause you never know who you're influencing and how you're influencing them.
Exactly.
Until you hear stories like that.
And it's the negative people that I hear from most.
Of course,
and I get myself in a lot of trouble. And I shoot my mouth off and I do stuff online to provoke or to create stuff. So I hear about the negatives. But every once in a while when you do hear something nice from somebody, like that's cool. I love that stuff.
And this is probably, we could probably do 2 hours on this, but we only got like 10 minutes left. What do you think is the state of comedy right now? A lot of people say it's dead, dying because of what you can and cannot say anymore. Then you have other comedians who have gone full political on one side of the aisle or the other. What do you think comedy is and what it should be? I know it's a super deep question for.
it's the thing is there's so many different elements to it.
Mm-hmm.
Comedy as an art form is thriving. If you want to be a stand-up and if you want to give it a try, it is so much better than it was when I started out. Even if you just think about the Berkshires and how any weekend somewhere there's a stand-up show going on somewhere in the Berkshires, whether it's, you know, whether it's a big guy up at the Colonial Theater or whether it's down at, you know, some smaller open mic type level, there's a scene. There's scenes in all these different cities. So where you can go and actually start to build your craft and learn how to do it, it's wonderful for that. the other half of it is politics and current events and stuff and what they bring into it is negative for the industry for so many reasons. First of all, the media focuses on the negative, right?
Right.
So they're giving all the attention and all the airtime to these right wing hacks, these guys out of Austin, the Joe Rogan people, and all that. They're not really necessarily very good comics to begin with, and they're really, when people are like, you can't say what you want to say, it's like, well, I mean, how racist do you want to be? Well, how evil do you want to be? If you want, you're still going to get some work. in some circles, if you want. But, you know, the other thing with the industry is what happened is, like, I think I'm part of a victim of, to tell you the truth, is, like, the other side of it is right. The overcompensating on, you know, diversity and on things like that, which is, diversity is wonderful. And you should, everybody should have a voice, and that's great. And because of the internet and so many cable channels, comedy can be for everybody, and you can have your own niche, and you can have that, you know. The problem is that just a middle-aged straight white guy isn't diverse. And so when they're looking, like, anytime there is a group that's being marginalized in society, you know, let's say when we were discussing gay marriage and stuff like that, you know, all of a sudden, well, now it's, we've got to find, you know, just the gay comics for this, or we've got to, you know, we've got to have, let's say you're the head writer of the Daily Show, right?
Yeah.
And you've been, you know, they were attacked at one point for not being diverse enough, even though, well, I think they were, and, you know, blah, blah, blah. But if you get attacked for that, and then the next time a job comes open and your first requirement is something about their ethnicity, you're not doing anybody any good. You're saying, okay, well, we need the next writer on the show has got to be Southeast Asian. Okay, great. Well, now you've given yourself a pool of 7 people to choose from mm-hmm. that job, as opposed to making the job, putting the bat signal out, making that job open for everybody, assigning each one an anonymous number so you don't know who the writer is, make it colorblind and go with that. Then you're going to get the best and the funniest people. And when you don't do it, when you go looking for people because of who they are, who they love, the color of their skin, their politics, that kind of stuff, you get to what ends up being just more not funny and more preachy. And to the point that I'm liberal and, you know, I agree with the politics and stuff, but I don't watch any of these late night shows anymore. I don't.
Really?
I don't watch a single minute of them. I just don't, you know, I don't think current events right now are entertaining. And so I've a long time ago, I kind of gave up on all that kind of stuff. I don't watch it.
Like, do you feel comedians have a responsibility to put that out there? Or would you prefer somebody who, I mean, I'm not into political comedy. I like, you know, just straight regular comedy.
Yeah.
I don't want to be reminded about what's going on in the world.
Right.
But there's some out there that do a great job. Like, I'm a huge Patton Oswalt mm-hmm. fan, and he's mm-hmm. dabbles in the political comedy. Has your comedy gotten more political, or?
Nope.
Okay.
No, it hasn't. Not on stage. On stage, it's more, I try to be more relatable to everybody and not do, because the thing is, I'm lazy, right? If you're going to do political current event comedy, all these jokes you write are only going to have a shelf life of about a month or two.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? It's like, if you just think about what was the biggest story 2 months ago, and especially now in the Trump administration, how things happen every day,
mm-hmm.
you know, you're doing jokes about God knows what that happened 3 months ago. People are moved on. And also, you're going to divide your audience. And I want to, when I do stand up, right, I look at it as an escape form for the audience. I look at it like Steve Martin wrote in his biography, his memoir, the reason he thought that he stood out in the 70s so much is that while everybody else was mired in Watergate and Vietnam and all that, and focused on that, he was like, I'm going to go the other way. So he was out on the stage in a white suit with a arrow through his head and a banjo and just being silly. And it was escapism. You didn't have to think about Vietnam. You didn't have to think about it. So I, you know, I feel bad. I have friends who worked as comedians, worked the way up, and now their entire career for the last 12 years has been just doing Donald Trump impressions and stuff like that. It's like, I didn't get into this industry, you know, to become an Elvis impersonator.
Right.
You know, that's not this. So also with that guy, I mean, how much of just how much of him is, he just wants to live in your head. He just wants to be famous, wants to live in your head and wants you thinking about him and everything else. And so I'm very much the opposite. I just look the other way. I'm like, I know how I'm keep up with the news. I know how I'm voting and everything else, but I'm not going to, you know, I'm not watching his press conferences, hanging on every word, hanging on every tweet and everything else. It's like, I'm not doing that. And especially after the last election, like, you know, you referenced the Super Bowl. I was a huge Patriots fan. I gave up on the NFL. I haven't watched an NFL game in a year and a half because, you know, just the corporate element and everything else. I got to a point where I'm like, I feel silly just rooting for one corporation over another. And I had 25 years of the Brady era. I don't think it's going to get better. You know, I hope the Patriots had a great game and all that. I wish them well, but, you know, I was always like, when I was watching, I felt like, you know, I would say to people, well, yeah, you just kind of have to look the other way at what the NFL does and just try to enjoy it for what it is and enjoy it for the game. And then at one point, the NFL is like, well, we're not even a sports organization anymore. We're an entertainment organization. So that means they're no different than the WWF, right? And as many, as great as Brady was and as great as, how many games came down to the last couple of minutes because of some pass interference play that gave them 50 yards out of nowhere? Like, the quality of the program, I always got grossed out when they would do all the military stuff because it's, you know, it just seems so cloying and so fake and all that kind of shit. I was just like, yeah, I'm over it. So I don't, you know, personally for me and for how I'm getting through all this stuff is like, I'm not turning to late night news as my source of entertainment. I'm not spending my time giving, you know, these big corporations the satisfaction. I've been watching older movies. I've been reading. I've been doing other things. I think somehow we've forgotten, just as a country, that, you know, it used to be that the news came on at 6 and was off at 6:30. And it wasn't this 24 news cycle. I have not, since November 8th, since, you know, I have not turned MSNBC on once. I never would watch Fox News or anything. I don't watch any cable news. I'm not going to be a part of this, whatever this corporate conglomeration is now. I'm not going to feed into it, and I'm not. So there is plenty of things out there in the world. I watched a movie called The Judgment at Nuremberg, which is a classic movie from 50 years ago, and it's as prescient today in some of the monologues and the things they were saying. It's as prescient today as anything. And, you know, Shakespeare never goes bad. You know, there's plenty of things out there. I just like to tell people, like, you don't have to tune in every day. You don't have to be informed. You know, I was for a long time. I watched. I always had the news on in the background and stuff. And then I found, okay, I'm just being manipulated, and it's not for me. So,
and it's so
blatant. I'm more a country of my own.
It's so blatant too. That it's happening. Yeah. That it feels it's catering to the lowest common denominator. And I mean, not to brag, like, you know, I feel like I'm smart enough to, like. Yeah, I see exactly what you're doing there. Like, you know, we talk about the sub-zero temperatures and the storms, and I'm like, you're just selling milk and bread. You don't know how bad this storm's going to be. Yeah. The Euro, the American model, like, why don't they ever agree, ever?
Yeah, or just, like, the hours and hours and hours that they spent on Trump's trials, on, oh, you know, how many headlines and stuff, new thing's going to take him down and this and that and every little bit of minutia. And it's like, they keep feeding off of this crap. And like, you know, you got that shell shock at the election, because if you were watching MSNBC, it's not that they were lying to you. It's just that, I don't know, the way they were framing it, they made it seem different, made it the way that the news was coming, it doesn't, it later on didn't seem like news. I don't know. It really disillusioned me with a lot of that stuff.
I feel like there's a lot of, you know, there's three lines. There's the normal line of normal telling of what is happening. There's the worst case scenario. Mm-hmm. And then there's like this best case scenario down here. And I just feel like everyone's always going to the worst case scenario to get everybody riled up.
Exactly. And you know what? Here's an example, too, about how, like, just the corporations working together to rile it all up and to manipulate this. So, obviously, as we're recording this, we don't know what's going to happen on Sunday. But let's talk about Bad Bunny for a second.
Okay? Oh, my God.
Here's the deal. I couldn't tell you a Bad Bunny song from a Good Bunny song. I have no idea. Couldn't pick the guy out of a lineup. Don't care about it. Why is it that the Super Bowl's halftime show has to be political, right? Why does it have to be making a statement? And I'm not saying that
it's not, though. It's just a guy, you know. Exactly. Everybody else has made it.
Exactly. I'm not saying that he's going out there and doing or saying anything. I'm saying the point is, the moment they put him out there, that put the people on the other side, you know, have had now 6 months of churning out articles and news reports and things about how upset we're supposed to be about Bad Bunny, right? How, and what a big deal about this. How much time of your life has already been spent to reading about a 15, 20 minute performance? You know what I mean? Like,
right.
And how many days have people been getting riled up? Did you got your, you know, your uncle or whatever who watches that crap is all worked up over this Bad Bunny and that God knows what's going to happen? And it's like they've created this guy into some monster, and he hasn't even performed yet. You know what I mean? And it's all that kind of crap. Like, I just feel manipulated. I feel like as soon as it comes September or whatever, they name the halftime show guarantee next year, whoever they name. It doesn't matter. He could be, you know, Lily White. It's going to piss other people off, and it's going to, and they're just going to get 4 or 5 months of the media churning out crap to engage. I'm not entertained. I'm not outraged. I'm just more outraged that I just, you know, I'm old and I don't know who these people are more than I care about their politics or anything else. It's just a show. Just let some people do a show.
It's like a 15-minute thing in the middle of the thing. Like, if you don't like it, go to your pickup truck, fire up some Skynyrd, smoke a J, and come back and watch the second half. I don't see what the big deal is. That's what's so frustrating.
Dude, I'm telling you, that's the way it was. I remember watching the Patriots Super Bowl and, like, you know, when Lady Gaga did it. I was at a bar when we went outside and had a cigarette. I don't know. I didn't watch it. I don't have to watch. And the whole thing about the Super Bowl and the, you know, it's really just about not the game. It's about the commercials.
Yeah.
It's the game is the filler for the commercials. And it's also like, how gross. I'm not going to watch. I'm not going to spend my whole 4 or 5 months getting outraged about who's performing at the halftime, wondering about the commercials, discussing the commercials later, you know, all that kind of crap. It's like, I don't want to be part of this big corporate machine. I'm not going to be, let them suck me in. So, like I said, so what I've been doing is filling my time with other things, reading and writing. And I hope people realize we do have centuries of literature and theater and science writing and anything you could get into. Get a hobby. Learn a, you know, do a jigsaw puzzle. Just turn the TV off. Step away. You know, tomorrow morning, the same thing's going to be going on. Trump's still going to be evil. The stuff's going on in Ukraine is still going to be going on. Stuff in the Middle East is still going on. And I can't do anything about any of it.
That's a great point. I got to cut you off because we're out of time.
Yeah.
We could do like another hour on this. But Kevin Bartini, thank you so much for joining us this morning, and we'll talk to you soon.
Oh, I hope so, man. Thanks. It was great to see you.
Thanks for coming. Great chat. Everybody else have a great day, and we will talk to you tomorrow here on Morning Drive here on WTBR.
That was fun.